You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
Gonna love today's podcast. I'm super excited about it. I had the opportunity to interview Nir Eyal. He is the author of Hooked, which is all about what makes technology and products addictive. We talked about that. We talked about how do you get people to want your product, to make it a habit, not just an every now and again thing. We talked about how entrepreneurs can compete against the big guys, how the marketplace, the playing field is actually a little more even because experience wins over advertising. And how Nir never goes to the grocery store.
So I'm so excited to talk to you and kind of dig into some things. You're the author of the book Hooked, which we're going to talk a lot about today. You write for Forbes, TechCrunch, Psychology Today. You lecture at Stanford. You've got this blog, Nir and Far, which is nirandfar.com. And I'll put all the links in the show notes so people don't have to worry about writing it down. And on your blog, you talk about being at the intersection of psychology, technology, and business. And I'm curious how you got to that intersection and what that means.
Well, so I started several years ago. I was in the advertising and gaming industry at my last startup. So I started two companies, and the last of which was this company that was at the intersection of these two industries that are really focused, if you think about it, on mind control, right? Advertisers don't spend all that money for their health. They spend that money to change user behavior, and the same with gaming. Many gaming companies, these are industries that are focused on changing user behavior. And so I got to see a lot of experiments at the intersection of those two industries. And, many times we were frustrated building solutions on our own team around what we should build and why sometimes user behavior was changed and people would do what we wanted them to do. And sometimes things didn't work. Right. And so what I found is that, surprisingly enough, even though these industries of advertising and gaming are so focused on changing user behavior, there wasn't really a manual or a how-to guide on how to change user behavior. And so when I was looking for how can I build better products and what we should build and how we should build them, I didn't really see anything practical out there from a standpoint of consumer psychology. And so, I found a lot of books that were interesting dinner party conversation, but not a lot of books about how to actually change our customers' behavior. And so that's really what I wanted to focus on, specifically habits. How do we create products that can bring users back time and time again without the need for expensive advertising and spammy messages? How do we form habits with our customers so that they can come back on their own?
So I want to dig into that quite a bit, actually. So let's talk, before we kind of delve in, talk a little bit about what, in your world, what habit forming means and what kind of Hooked actually is really about, so they have some context to the conversation we're about to have.
Sure. So habits are these behaviors done with little or no conscious thought. It's about half of what you do every single day is done automatically. It's done with little or no conscious thought. And it turns out that there's a lot of products out there whose business model requires habits. Now, I should note, not every business model needs habits. There's lots of ways to get customers back to your place of business. You can use search engine optimization. You can use advertising. Heck, you could have a physical storefront, right? You could set up shop somewhere on a corner and customers will find you. But what this is really focused on, what my work focuses on, is if you're the kind of company that requires habits, if you can't afford not to have habits, meaning just like the companies that we see that are some of the most habit-forming products out there, like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Pinterest and Slack, these companies would go out of business if they had to pay for ads to bring users back all the time. So if you're in that kind of business, if you're in the kind of business where you require users to come back on their own, what my work and what my book will teach you is how do you create these mental associations with internal triggers, which we'll talk about in a bit, that can bring users back unprompted, that can bring users back on their own. Now, even if you're not in the kind of business that requires a habit, what I try and do with this book is to give you techniques that you can use piecemeal. So if you're building a habit-forming product, you have to have it all. You have to have the entire hook model, which we can walk through the four steps of what the hook actually is. But if you're not creating a habit-forming product, I think everybody in business today needs to understand their users. They need to understand their deeper psychology of why people do what they do so that they can build better products to improve their lives.
Do you think that you had said something that just struck me, which was kind of if they have to come back on their own?
Right.
Do you think, when I think about the world out there, whether it's a retail shop or an app or a web-based business, I mean, it's so cluttered that don't kind of many businesses really, in a sense, need to make sure that their customers are coming back on their own, kind of at least have that trigger, external trigger or internal trigger to kind of come back on their own?
Right. So it's a huge competitive advantage to have a habit-forming product. I mean, there's lots of reasons that habit-forming products win. And look, the cold, hard truth is that many times in the marketplace, it's not the best product that wins.
Yeah.
I mean, the history of business does not state, there's no law that says the best products win. That is not the case. Many times, it's just the products that are stickier. It's the ones that are first to mind that win. A great example of that is Google versus Bing. You know, Google has tremendous market share advantage when it comes to people using their search engine. But when you think about it, actually, there's been third-party studies that have shown that when you strip out the branding and you compare the search results of Google versus Bing, there's almost a 50-50 split. People can't really tell the two apart. And yet, we all go to Google out of habit, right? It's something we do with little or no conscious thought. In fact, Bing is so desperate to get you to try their product because we don't even know if it's better. Most of us don't even give the competition a chance. It's purely out of habit. So they actually will pay users. They give you points for searching with Bing. But, of course, most of us don't even know that exists because we're just so habituated. Every time we're uncertain, we Google it. It's instantaneous. It's become a verb. It's just something we do. We don't even consider, hey, maybe there's a better solution out there. So it turns out that forming a habit in your user's mind is a huge competitive advantage. It keeps others out of your market, so to speak. It retains your customers for longer. It increases customer lifetime value. It supercharges growth. It gives you more pricing flexibility. So there's lots of reasons why habits are really good for the bottom line.
And, you know, going back to your kind of Google Bing example, it also begs the question of does that user even care about rewards? Is that even the driver?
That's the irony is that, you know, that many times we do these things with little or no conscious thought so that we just pick based on availability, not only physical availability, but also mental availability, that the first to mind solution is what wins, because most of the time people aren't looking for a new solution. They've got their solution. They know what they want and they just want that product to give them what they're looking for.
You know, one of the things that I found really intriguing about this book was this, you know, you were talking about it in it about the Don Draper days are over, and you kind of hinted at it just now. And I used to work on Madison Avenue, so I was kind of happy to see that way, way back in the day out of college. I wanted to be in big advertising. But it's really no longer about that, right? It's not about, I don't know if it's even talking to people or even talking with people, because then it was all about social media and, you know, having conversations. But you talk about actually taking them through a series of experiences. And what it sounds like to me is that actually helps level the playing field for startups. So if it's not really just about big budgets, that means there's a little bit more of an even playing field for products to get to market. And then I think the second level to that is to what you were just saying, which is even if you get to market, can you do it in a way that gets people to take action?
Right. So if you're a startup, don't compete with the big brands, right? Like if you've got a great new idea for a cola drink, don't do it, you know?
because
you're not going to win. Maybe if you have something really different in a whole new category, that's a different story, but even that might not be a very good idea compared to the behemoths, but, you know, there are exceptions. But to go head-to-head with Coca-Cola or Pepsi or with any kind of commodity good, gasoline, you know, Chevron or Exxon. I mean, these are commodity goods, right? Or insurance for your car. You're not going to fight with Geico and Progressive over what are essentially commodity goods. There's not that much of a difference. They're very difficult to differentiate. So for those type of brands, Coke and Chevron and Geico, all they can do is create the mental association because they've pushed the physical availability as far as they can. You're always within an arm's reach of a Coke, right? It's just ubiquitous. So they can't do anything more. So all they can spend their billions on is these creating these mental associations, which are effective. But what I try and emphasize to entrepreneurs, you know, who are just getting started, you can't afford to compete in that space.
Right.
But the good news is that because the cost of creating these new technologies is so cheap today, and the know-how is so much more accessible than it used to be, that you can, you know, you don't have to buy servers anymore. You can rent those kind of things. You can learn how to HTML very quickly. You can learn how to build apps overnight almost. I mean, it's not very difficult like it used to be. So the difference now is to create those mental associations, to create these habits, we no longer need to advertise like the big brands do, that we can actually instead use experiences. And that's what's different. That we can create habits of thought, we can create habits of behavior, not just through repetitious advertising, but through these experiences.
So talk a little bit then about what experiences, what that really means and how you think about that. And, you know, as you were talking about Coke and Chevron and all those guys, you know, I was thinking about our business, the Shook, and how we had to make sure we weren't just an online retailer, that we're actually a testing ground. For that reason, we weren't going to compete against Amazon. We weren't going to win if we tried to be that model. But as you were talking, I started to think about, this may sound really out in left field, but Uber versus taxis and kind of Lyft and kind of that whole thing. And I don't know if that applies here, if you have any kind of thoughts on that and where you were headed with experiences.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great example of how, you know, Uber didn't advertise to get people. They didn't buy billboard ads to get people to use Uber. Maybe they did buy some Super Bowl ads this year. I don't know. I didn't see any, but I don't remember Uber putting a lot of ads out there. But, you know, what they did was to create an experience that did their marketing for them. It created these habits for them. So there's some very good hooks built into a product like Uber that takes users through these experiences. So that, you know, I was just actually in San Diego yesterday at a conference, and, you know, as soon as I stepped out of my hotel and I needed to get to the airport, I didn't wait a second to see if there was even a cab around. I just instantly went to my Uber app and called the cab.
That's so, it's so interesting how it's been so disruptive in the category, but yet at the same time used a completely different model to achieve it.
Right, that's right. And it's because of, you know, they're leveraging these amazing technologies that we all carry around with us in our pockets.
So I actually implemented a couple things, actually three things that I want to share with you and get your thoughts on, the kind of concepts behind them, because I found the results so fascinating. And I just want to say, when you're listening out there, that that's one of the great things about this book I found in particular, is it really wasn't a book where I felt like I read it was good and I put it on a shelf. It really had a lot of application, and I pulled a lot of things out, which was just great.
That's music to my ears. Thank you. You know, I read a lot of business books, and I read a lot of books to do the research for this book. And most of them bore me to tears because, you know, there are these stories and these anecdotes about this one person who was at this one company and tried this one thing and looked how it worked. But then when you get to the end of the chapter and you think to yourself, okay, well, how do I apply this stuff? You know, good luck. The author doesn't take you there. And that's exactly what I didn't want to do. So thank you so much. My goal with the book was, you know, I was a two-time entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I know how difficult it is when you're in the trenches and you're struggling to figure out, why aren't users doing what I want them to do? How can I build this better product? So at the end of every chapter, I'm sure you saw this, it says, not only is there a summary of the chapter for the time-starved entrepreneurs out there, it just tells you, you know, in bullet point fashion what you need to know, but then it also takes you through this do this now section where it tells you, okay, for your business, step by step by step, answer question one, then answer question two, then answer question three, and through this process, you'll figure out what you need to build into your product.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I loved about it. I'll be blunt, and I don't think anyone who knows me would consider this a surprise. I tend to start business books and then never finish them because I find them to be so boring.
And you're not alone. Everybody does that.
Right, and it's, you know, they make me work so hard to pull out the application, and frankly, I just don't have the time. So
I hear you.
Even the good ones, so I appreciate that. So there were three things that I implemented kind of based on some of the concepts I want to talk about. Before we do that though, will you quickly walk through the hooked model? Because I think it'll make the rest of that conversation more meaningful for people.
Sure. So real quick, I'll give you the kind of the 30,000 foot overview of the hook model. The hook is an experience designed to connect your user's problem to your solution with enough frequency to form a habit. And it's through these four steps of the hook that user preferences are changed, that attitudes are shaped, and that these habits take hold. So real quick, the four basic steps of the hook, and we can talk about this, I'm sure, more in the hour here, about what, even more in depth onto each step. But the four basic steps of a hook are a trigger. Triggers come in two types. There are internal triggers and external triggers. Triggers are things that tell the user what to do next. They give them some kind of information for what to do next. The difference between an external trigger and an internal trigger is that the external trigger contains the information. So a call to action button that says click here or buy now or a friend telling you to install this new app, that's great, you should really try it out. All examples of external triggers. The information is in the trigger itself. Internal triggers, however, the information for what to do next is inside the user's head. So what you do with little or no conscious thought, spontaneously, when you're in a certain place, in a certain situation, around certain people, taking part in a certain routine, or most frequently when you experience a particular emotion, dictates what you do next. So, for example, when we're feeling bored, we hop onto YouTube or check the news or stock prices. When we're lonely, we check Facebook. When we're uncertain, as we talked about before, we Google it. And so these mental associations with emotions are very frequent internal triggers, and they tend to be negative emotions. Mm-hmm. Now, after the internal trigger comes the action phase. The action phase is the behavior itself. It's the simplest thing the user does to get a reward. And so we can talk more about why the action phase is more important. The key principle here is that by making the behavior easier to do, we're more likely to make the behavior occur. So something as simple as a swipe on Pinterest or pushing the play button on YouTube, they're examples of these very simple behaviors that we do in anticipation of reward. So product developers should always be thinking about how can we make getting to the reward as easy as possible. That, of course, leads me to the next step of the hook. The reward phase tends to be a variable reward. Rewards have a very long, there's a lot of science around the science of research around rewards. Much of it stems from the work of Olds and Milner, who discovered this very special part of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, which turns out that what we now know becomes very active in anticipation of a reward. And then we know that the way the brain gets us to act, the way the brain gets us to do these behaviors time and time again, is by creating this itch, this craving response. And so in all sorts of products that we find most habit-forming and most engaging, you'll find not only a reward, but more importantly, a variable reward. And this, of course, comes out of the work of B.F. Skinner, the father of operant conditioning, who found that when a reward is given on a variable schedule of reinforcement, the behavior occurs more frequently, and it's harder to extinguish. So it becomes a behavior that we do over longer periods of time when there's a bit of mystery. So if you think about gambling, right? What makes casinos habit-forming and potentially addictive? There's this slot machine effect of uncertainty about what you're going to win.
Right, next time I'll win. Next one.
Right, exactly. And that's exactly the same mechanism that we find in many habit-forming technologies. So, for example, when you open up your Facebook news feed, you'll find this infinite scroll that you can search and search and never done search through these posts. So there's a lot of uncertainty about what did people post? What are the comments going to say? How many likes did something get? There's all this uncertainty as you're scrolling and scrolling through your news feed or your Pinterest feed or your Twitter feed. And then finally comes the investment phase. The investment phase is where the user puts something into the product, some bit of value, some bit of work into the product to increase the likelihood of the next pass through the hook. And investments increase the likelihood of the next pass through the hook in two ways. Number one, they load the next trigger. So when you send someone a message on WhatsApp, for example, when you send that message, there's no immediate gratification. Remember, that's the action phase is all about immediate gratification. The investment phase is for a future reward. So when you send someone a message, you don't get any points, you don't get any badges, there's no leaderboard, nothing really happens. But what you're doing is loading the next trigger because you will soon likely receive a reply. And when you get that reply, that's accompanied with a notification. And that notification, of course, is an example of an external trigger.
Right.
And that external trigger gives you the information for what to do next, open the app, and passes you through the hook once again. And then finally, the last way that the investments increase the likelihood of the next pass is by storing value. So accruing followers, or giving the company more data, or accruing a reputation score, or storing content, or learning a new skill through a product, or giving money to a product so that you can use it in the future, are all examples of storing value. Something that I do that makes the product better and better and better with use. So the more data I give to Pinterest or Facebook or any of these companies, the more data I give them, the better the product becomes to me. I can do more and more with the product. So investments load the next trigger, and they store value. And that's how the hook continues in the future.
So I really hope that the people listening pulled out a blank piece of paper and a pen and just wrote down what you're talking and then go buy the book and actually delve into it. Because that was,
right.
to your that, point, that was
it's a 250-page book that I tried to condense there into, 30 seconds?
well, that was like the 30,000-foot blueprint of, you know, how to get up Kilimanjaro. Right. But then you got to dig into like
exactly.
That was great. So I want to talk about some of the things we did, which are very basic, kind of, I don't want to say basic and simple, but they're kind of small things that we pulled out from the book that we said, let's try these and let's see what happens. So I want to talk a little bit about them. And I may have the concept maybe wrong or not quite right. So bear with me. I'll just share with you what we did and the results. And maybe you can talk about the concept behind it and why it worked or didn't.
Sure.
Yeah. So one of the things we did is we have a voting period. So we launch new inventions all the time to our – we have a community of early adopters. And they get to test them out, kick the tires around, and then give feedback on those inventions directly to the inventor as well. So
okay.
To help make the product better. So – and then we also have a testing ground where we send out samples, concepts, or full products from kind of mid- and large-sized companies – and again, people test it out, kick the tires around, and give feedback and insights. So it's a big testing ground. So we had a voting period, which really in a lot of ways is investment for the products about to be launched to buy, which I hadn't really thought about. But one of the things we said, the voting period is 48 hours, and they basically vote products, thumbs up, thumbs down. And one of the things that we did is we actually went in and started giving variable rewards, so rewards to people who were voting, and then obviously publicizing that reward that so-and-so, you know, is going to get a free invention or get this or get that for voting. What we discovered when we, and I was thinking of it as a variable reward, but tell me if I'm wrong, is that when we gave those surprise rewards out in a truncated period of time, the next 24 hours, the voting more than doubled.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we were thinking
that's
it was
validating,
variable.
I guess.
What's that?
That's validating.
Yeah, exactly. We were thinking of it as variable reward, but talk a little bit about kind of from the hooked model, what happened there?
Well, so there's a lot of fascinating research around why rewards given on a variable schedule of reinforcement, meaning you know, sometimes you get the reward, sometimes you don't, why that tends to increase responses. It increases the intended behavior. This, of course, comes out of the classic research of B.F. Skinner, the father of operant conditioning. You probably remember Skinner from your Psych 101 class.
Yeah.
He had these famous experiments where he took pigeons, he put them in a little box, he gave them a disc to peck at, and every time the pigeon would peck at this disc, at first they would receive a reward. They would get a little food pellet. Mm-hmm. So basically he would train these pigeons to peck at this disc whenever they were hungry, right? Big deal. So, but then he did something that was a little unexpected. What he did was introduce a variable reward. So sometimes the pigeons would peck at the disc and nothing would happen. The next time the pigeon would peck at the disc, they would receive a little food pellet. They would receive the reward. And what Skinner observed was that the rate of response, the number of times the pigeons pecked at this disc, increased. It occurred more frequently when the reward was given on a variable schedule of reinforcement. And so we see in all sorts of products that we see offline and online, you know, from online products like Facebook and Twitter and Stack Overflow and Pinterest and Slack, to offline products like what makes casino gambling fun or what makes sports, right? We just finished the Super Bowl. You know, I love watching people watch sports. It is fascinating how engaged and in pain people are.
It's so personal.
Right? Same exact principle, variable reward.
You
know, nobody wants to know a game where they know, they don't want to watch a game where they know what exactly what's going to happen. The whole fun of the game is this unpredictable nature. And of course, we see this not only in sports, we see this in media, right? What makes a movie good is that you don't know the ending. If somebody tells you how the happy ending is going to resolve, it's not that interesting anymore. Same with a book, right? How many times do we read a book more than once? Almost never. Why? Because we know what's going to happen, right? When we know how things are going to resolve themselves, we don't pick up that book again. We don't read the newspaper more than once. Why? Because the whole reason why we keep engaging time and time and time again is because of this uncertainty, is this element of variability.
You know, it's funny. I was just thinking back to how I used to watch Law and Order at night, and at about the 45-minute mark, you always knew who did it, basically. Right, so I'd always just fall asleep. Like, I swear, it was 45 minutes, I was asleep, and I'd have to wake up later and say, was I right? To my husband.
There you
because
go.
I always fell asleep once I figured out who did it. So it is, yes.
Yeah, that's a big, I mean, and that's a real defining element of good content, right?
Yeah.
A good book is a cliffhanger, right? Is one that leaves you wondering until the very end. That's what makes it interesting. Makes you. That's what makes for a page turner. It's also, it turns out, what makes for great tech products are these products that have an element of mystery, or I should put a little asterisk here, or products that can take something that is inherently variable, that is something that the user inherently does not have a lot of control over, and makes them more predictable. So let me give an example of that. Uber, I think one of the things that makes Uber successful, and others like it, not just Uber, but Lyft and Sidecar, and there's a lot of other companies that use the same principle now in the transportation space, they took something that was uncomfortably variable, right? Mm-hmm. So if you need to get from point A to point B, and you call the taxi company, I'm sure you remember this, they would tell you, yeah, we'll be there in 15.
Yeah.
Sometimes they would be there in 5 minutes. Sometimes they would be there in 15. Sometimes they would be there in an hour. Sometimes they wouldn't come at all. And you had no way to know where that damn cab was. That was too much variability, right? That was outside of our control. We had very little agency to control that situation. So what Uber does is come along and give us this beautiful little icon on our phone where we can see exactly where the taxi is. And now all of a sudden, something that was once too variable, too outside our control, they give us a higher degree of agency, right? Now we feel like we can control it. We know what's going on. We know where that cab is. We can see how far away it is. It's not actually all that accurate, right? So it'll tell you 4 minutes, 3 minutes, but at least it gives us a greater sense of control and agency over something that is too variable. Same thing with Google. Google wouldn't want to make its search results more variable. They wouldn't want to make them worse for the sake of adding variability. What they've done is take something that is inherently very variable,
right?
Something that searching for what you're looking for is hard. If you remember the old way we used to do it on Yahoo search back in the day, you know, we used to have to go through these taxonomy of lists, right? So shopping, and then click down to another category, cars, and then click down to another category, and it would take you a long time to get to what you were looking for. So Google gave us this system that gave us greater agency and control over search, something that is inherently variable. So it's really about that ratio of variability.
Yeah, so if I hear you correctly, if I'm launching a new product, business, technology, kind of whatever it is, if you can find a way to pull out some of the uncomfortable variability, maybe, I don't know, is it fair to say maybe you have a greater chance of success in having some, you know, when the other flip side of it is a new innovation or a little riskier? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Right. It's really about what the customer is coming for. So the rule here when it comes to variable rewards, I hear a lot of times people talk about gamification and how, you know, gamification is about adding these game-like elements of points and badges and leaderboards. And sometimes it works and sometimes it's a huge disaster. And the difference is when the reward isn't rewarding to the user. If the reward is rewarding, that's terrific, right? That's great.
Yeah.
The user will keep coming back. What's important here is that we remember that there has to be this fundamental linkage between the variable reward and the internal trigger. So if the variable reward is about if the internal trigger is about alleviating boredom, if that's why the user would turn to this product multiple times a day, well, then the variable reward has to entertain. If the internal trigger is loneliness, seeking connection, well, then the variable reward has to connect people together. We can't just willy-nilly put on variable rewards and expect them to work. We have to make sure that they fundamentally scratch the user's itch. They have to give the user what they came for, because remember, the point of the variable reward is to give the user what they came for, to scratch their itch, to satisfy their need, and yet leave a bit of mystery around what they might find the next time they engage with the product.
And that goes back to kind of that section in your book about truly understanding the triggers of
your
customers.
Important.
Yeah, and how, I mean, I've been in innovation for a long time, and I think that's one of the first things people miss is the why behind it. Why would
Right.
your customer really, truly, deeply want this? And I loved your email example because I would have never thought that deeply about why it is I click, do I have anything? So often.
It's something that way too many people just kind of pass over, and they don't think about, it's interesting in the technology industry specifically, we have a lot of people who are really good at coming up with functional requirements and technical requirements, and we have pages and pages around what we have to build from a functional perspective and what the product has to do. But we spend almost no time thinking about the psychological requirements. We don't think about, what itch the product has to scratch for our user. And that, let me tell you, that decision fundamentally changes what you build. A product that caters to boredom or is going to be totally different from a product that caters to uncertainty, for example. Completely different products.
Well, and you're talking about a very on a very deep level, which I think is important. And I see it all the time when companies or individual inventors come to me with new inventions that they want me to test out, and they'll say, "Well, it solves this." And my response back is always, "Well, but why does the customer want that solved, really?"
Interesting. And the one test I like to give, by the way, is to, show me the nascent behavior. Show me the existing habit that somebody is solving this problem with scotch tape and bubble gum, right? They're using old technologies and difficult to use solutions to solve this problem. But what sometimes I hear that drives me nuts is when I say, how is the user currently solving this problem? How are they currently scratching the itch? Sometimes I'll hear some bushy-tailed and bright-eyed entrepreneur will tell me, "Oh no, you don't understand, Nir. There is no solution for this. This is something, and I'm always a little bit skeptical there because that probably means there's no problem, right? There always has to be an existing solution, or it's probably not a problem. I don't care if it's, archaic technology and Excel spreadsheets and pen and paper. That's great, but there always has to be an existing solution, or it's probably not a problem.
I love that. And it always begs the question too, on top of that, of, well, if they are solving it with duct tape, and that's, in your mind, is the inventor not good enough? But does the customer really care enough to solve it to the next level? Maybe, maybe not.
Right, that's true. But at least then, if you can show me, they are solving this problem, but they get out an Excel spreadsheet and then they keep a pad and paper and then they're using this solution. They're like stitching together five different products. Ooh, then I'm in. I'm excited, right? That's the kind of stuff I love to find because then what you're doing is you have this opportunity in the action phase to make the reward come easier, right? To make the distance between the recognized need and the reward smaller. And if you think about it, that's actually the nature of all innovation. I don't care if it's the cotton gin or the iPhone, all of these products fundamentally reduce the distance between the recognized need and the reward. And that's what I look for.
That's a great way to say it. That's a great way to say it. Because that really encompasses both, I think, products that solve something in the past, like here is a specific problem we're solving better, and things like you mentioned, the iPhone. I mean, that was such a forward-thinking concept. I don't know that if you put consumers in a focus group, they could say, "I want a phone that does this and that, or an iPad." But it did fundamentally reduce that distance at the end of the day.
And one of Apple's secrets that I don't like talking too much about Apple because it's such a widely used example. But in this respect, if you think about it, Apple's always seen as a super innovative company. But if you think about it, they've actually never gone into a new category. They've never been first, right? They weren't the first to create the personal computer. They weren't the first to create the MP3 player. They weren't the first to create the tablet. They're not even the first to create the smartwatch. What they do is they see the other people going into these markets, many of them mature markets. I mean, the markets for MP3 players, if you remember before the iPod, there was a big market for
I
MP3
believe
players.
I had a couple of MP3
Right?
players
I did
before the
too. They
iPod.
sucked. They were terrible.
Oh,
But
horrible.
people, they were demonstrating to jobs that there was a need here, right? There was an existing habit that people were trying to satisfy. And of course, look back even further before the MP3 player, we had CD, portable CD players, we had Walkmans. This was an existing habit that people already had in their lives.
Well, just to age myself, I did have my yellow sports Walkman, so
There you go.
I was
Which
very
is probably now
happy.
a collector's edition.
It totally. All right, so let's I mean we could I think I'd love to have a whole separate conversation about innovation in the world that I play in, but let's keep going in this because I think there's so much more that I want to ask you about. So the second thing that we did is you use the example actually of mint.com in your book about being very clear about what's the action I'm asking you to take as the user. So we tended to, in our emails, embed links all over and, do this and click here. And we changed it and kind of went with your clear action, that clear trigger, and had a kind of big visual of like click here to buy or, click here to read, whatever it was. And we have a pretty high engagement rate to begin with, but it went up another 3%.
Oh, this is
I
great.
know
I
when we
love
made
it.
that
I'm
change.
waiting for you to tell me what didn't work, but I'm glad to
Oh.
hear that I'm two out of two so far. That's
Two out of
great.
two. So I'd love for you to talk about that clear action thing because when I get, and now every time I get emails from people in particular, because that's such an important way to communicate with our customers these days, I get so frustrated because there's 15 links. And, I've kind of always subscribed to the idea of if you give someone too much choice, and there have been studies on this too, that you actually reduce the chances of them engaging with you because it's just too overwhelming.
Right,
But you take it
right.
kind of to a whole new level of being very clear and concise about what that trigger is.
Right. And to be clear, okay, so let me get the macro and then I'll go down to the
Yeah.
micro here. So the macro here is that we want to make it as easy as possible for the user to do the intended behavior. And that message cannot be overstated, that if you have an intended behavior in mind, the best thing you can do is to clear the cognitive clutter, to make it extremely easy for the user to figure out what it is you want them to do. So that's the macro level. And there's a lot more to be said here. There's other ways you can manipulate the likelihood of a behavior by using motivation. There's these six principles of motivation, these six levers of ability that are in the book. But for the sake of our discussion here, that's the overarching principle, is what can you do to make the intended behavior as easy as possible? That being said, for example, if you were to subscribe to my email newsletter, my intended behavior is to get you just to open the email, and I want you to peruse. My email, where I want you to spend time, is not necessarily on my site. I don't really actually care if people come to my site. The purpose of my newsletter is to give you interesting content for you to peruse. So I give a little sample of each article I write, and there's actually a lot of links, but that's okay for me because that's where I want people to engage. I want people to engage inside my newsletter. And if they click over and read the article, terrific. But I want to make sure that they open the email. That's really what's super important to me. Now, if I, on the other hand, if my metric for success was people have to click on this email, right? That's what I want them to do. They have to click on the email in order to come to my site. I would have designed my emails totally different. I would have a really big call to action button with a minimal amount of text that provides very clear directions for what the intended behavior is.
And I think what's important about what you're saying here is that there isn't just one way to do it. The question is, what's the action you're actually asking them to take, and how do you make it easy and appropriate for them?
Right. But it starts with what is the intended behavior itself, which is,
Yeah.
that's where I want people to apply this hook, is if you're building a product that you want to turn into a habit. The best thing you can do is to sit down for a minute and plot out what is your trigger, action, reward, investment. What's your hook that's going to bring people back time and time again, and then go build, right? Use the
Yeah.
fundamentals of psychology that hundreds of very smart people, if not thousands of very smart people, have worked to create this research in academia for decades and decades. Use that research to build a better product on paper first, and then go out and build it and test it and learn from it. But what a lot of people do is first they build it without any kind of guidance into these fundamental principles of user psychology, which can save them a lot of time and heartache.
It's funny. I got a psychology major from UC Berkeley way back in the day, and people always said, "Well, how are you going to use that in business?" Turns out,
Oh,
it's actually quite handy.
yeah. That's a very good degree. It's a
Yeah,
very useful degree
who knew?
nowadays.
I could go on about the things that we've kind of tried and kind of what's happened, but I want to keep going because there's some other areas I want to dig into. In the world of innovation, we're always trying to, quote unquote, build a better mousetrap, as they say. But you make the point, you alluded to it earlier, that sometimes those new ideas lose. It's not always the, truly the best idea that wins. And part of that, as you talk about in your book, is because the cost of changing habits may be too high. So moving from Google to Bing is just too much work to get me off Google. Which I guess the flip side of that is that some businesses may still be winning only because the cost of change is too high to leave them. What's going on? What's going on with all that?
Right, so there's that's kind of the double-edged sword of habits. That if you're lucky enough to have a habit-forming product, bully for you, that's fantastic. It erects huge barriers to entry, and it's very hard for someone to come in and swoop in and take your customers away. The downside of habit-forming products is that if you're a new entrant into the market, That sucks
Yeah.
because it's going to be very hard for you to displace an existing an incumbent that has very strong user habits. So there are really only three ways, maybe three and a half ways. I'll tell you why three and a half ways in a minute, that you can break an existing competitor's habits. And the way to do that, number one, is to increase the velocity through the hook. So if you can make a product where people pass through those four steps of trigger, action, reward, and investment faster than the incumbent, so we talked about earlier how you can, make the product easier to take those key actions. If you can find a way to make that behavior easier and therefore increase the speed with which people pass through these four steps, that's way number one. Way number two is if you can increase the frequency of passing through the hook. So for example, whenever there's a new interface developed, so when we went from desktop to laptop to now mobile phones, the fact that now that we carry our technologies in our pocket with us means that we can take these old habits and we can engage with them more frequently through these new companies on our cell phones. So, for example, picture taking. Picture taking before used to mean I had to grab my camera, find my SLR. Did I have it with me? Did I not have it with me? Take off the lens cap and open it up and take a picture. Well, now what happened is suddenly, because my phone is my camera and my camera is my phone, the frequency with which I can take and post pictures went up dramatically. It's something that it doesn't happen just once a week when I remember to bring my camera with me on the weekends, but it's happening all the day, all day, every day. And so that's where these new incumbents, destroyed the old company. I mean, these new entrants destroyed the old incumbents by providing solutions that could get people to go through the hook more frequently. So number one is velocity. Number two is frequency. Number three is when the reward is more rewarding. So if you can find a way, we talked about this earlier, of how can the reward scratch the user's itch better? How can you provide a product that third fundamental step of the hook, the reward phase, is better in some way? And so the example I love to give here is the battle between Snapchat and Facebook. Snapchat is this messaging service. It's incredibly popular. It's reported to have rebuffed an offer from Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook for $3 billion. Apparently now they're raising it up at a $10 billion valuation. Well, if you ask yourself, why does Snapchat worry a guy like Mark Zuckerberg? Why would he be willing to pay $3 billion for this little app that, was started by a few Stanford kids? Well, part of it is that the reward is more rewarding. What's special about Snapchat is that, when someone sends an image, a picture on Snapchat, is what's amazing about Snapchat, what's interesting, the key feature is that these pictures explode. They disappear. And so what does that do to user discretion, or I should say indiscretion, around what they post? Well, they post flirtatious and sexy and funny pictures that, because they know they're gone, they won't be on the web forever, they do that more frequently.
Which you're not going to
And
do on Facebook.
exactly, which you would not do on Facebook. So if I get a message on Facebook from my Aunt Matilda, or if I get a picture on Snapchat from, somebody I've been flirting with, which message, which notification am I going to open first? Of course, it's going to be Snapchat because the reward is more rewarding. There's more variability. It's more interesting. And so that's exactly what scares a guy like Mark Zuckerberg. The reward is more rewarding. And so he really doesn't want to lose that habit, which is now threatened by this new product. And then the three and a half, the half solution, this I say it's a half because the question is, how do you get your competitors' customers' habits? And the halfway, the almost fourth way, is when you make entering the product easier, when you make using the product for the first time, the onboarding, easier to do. So, for example, I like to give here is Microsoft Office has lost a tremendous market share to Google Docs. Well, part of the reason for that is that using Google Docs, it doesn't have all the full features of a product like Microsoft Office, but it's just so easy to use to start using it. I don't have to buy any software.
Right.
I
I'm
don't need
already
any
on
special
Google.
training. Yeah, it's in the cloud. I just hop on Google and I can start typing away. I don't have to download anything. I just start to use it immediately. So the reason I call that a half reason is because that's not very good for bringing over your existing customers. That's hard to get people who are diehard Excel fans to start using Google Sheets. That's kind of hard to do. But for the new generation, right, for new customers, now we're talking. So people who grew up on the web, very few of them, you know, college kids don't use Microsoft Office, right? They're using Google Docs if they need to use such a program, because it was so much easier to get into it in the future.
I just have to kind of back up and take a deep breath for a second and say that if you're listening, I feel like you just gave an amazing blueprint to really think about how to overcome some of those hurdles and barrier to entry, regardless if you're going up a behemoth or even just a crowded marketplace and competition, which most everybody has. I mean, anyone who tells me they don't have competition, I think is fooling themselves. I feel like that was a fantastic blueprint. So if you're listening, I would write those things down.
The good news is that it's also on my blog.
Yes.
I blog about this stuff all the time. Mm. So I've written about that. That particular analysis of those 3.5 reasons is not in the book, but it is on my blog.
Yeah, nearandfar.com, which I will put in the show notes. So,
thank you.
Oh my gosh, I have so many questions. We're almost out of time. So I'm going to try to get to the ones that I think are most important. You know, you talk a little bit about vitamins versus painkillers.
Right.
And I love that analogy because, you know, I've done years of innovation in beauty, you know, wellness products, and people are always trying to build a vitamin that people will actually take every day.
Mm-hmm,
and I think
mm-hmm.
they think of it a little incorrectly, which is exactly a vitamin that you take every day. So talk a little bit about kind of vitamins versus painkillers. And maybe if you can give an example of how you know when you've moved past, because if I understand correctly, sometimes you start as a vitamin, but you can move over into the painkiller category.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's interesting. You know, what we teach the typical MBA is that, you know, you don't want to build the vitamin. The vitamin product is a nice to have. It's mm-hmm. it's something that people take out of an emotional need. You know, if we go on vacation, we forget to take our vitamins. No big deal.
Right.
Painkillers, on the other hand, that's the kind of product that investors want to invest in. And if you work for a company, that's the kind of product that or the kind of innovation that your boss will get excited about, right? Something that your customer can articulate to you that they need, right? Stop my pain. It's an articulatable need they can tell you they have. And if you can stop that pain, great. There will be a quantifiable market there. And so the traditional wisdom is don't waste your time on vitamin products. Don't build, you know, things that people find nice to have. Instead, only build the things that people must have, right? Build mm-hmm. the painkillers. But here's where that analysis and that standard wisdom goes a little wrong. If you think about the products that have had such a massive impact on users' day-to-day behaviors, their day-to-day habits, some of the products we talked about earlier, like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and WhatsApp, you know, all of these companies started out as vitamins.
Yeah.
They started out. Nobody woke up 10 years ago in the middle of the night before Facebook existed and said, I need to update my status. You know, that never happened.
Right.
They didn't know they had that need. But what we found was that through repetitive use of the product, by passing through these four steps of the hook, when these products became habits, they became indispensable. So that if tomorrow Mark Zuckerberg said, you know what? I've made enough money. We're going to shut down Facebook. I'm done with this. I'm sorry. The site's going dark.
Oh, my goodness.
Today, people would have connection fits.
Oh, my God. There'd be a revolt.
Right? That would be a big problem for people. Yeah. So that's evidence that what these products that sometimes start out as vitamins, these nice-to-haves, and by the way, this is a trend in technology that has repeated time and time again, not just with the current crop of social networking companies, but even farther back, you know, look at the personal computer. Also dismissed as a little toy, something that maybe hobbyists would use. Before that, the telegraph and the telephone also, all these inventions frequently were kind of dismissed as these nice-to-haves, these things that aren't that all that important. But then over time, when they become things, particularly these communication devices, when they become part of our daily lives, it's something that's very hard for us to live without.
That's great. You were absolutely right about Facebook. If that went away, and you know, to your point about kind of really scratching an itch, it really is about social acceptance, which you talk about a little, kind of in other parts of your book.
Right.
I mean, God,
right.
Does somebody like me? Do they like my post? How many people like my post?
And that's not a new need. You know, that's something that our species, you know, that for 200,000 years, our species lived in these small communities of 150 people or so, and we knew everybody, and everybody knew us. Well, today we're in an unnatural state, right? It's not these technologies that are unnatural. It's the fact that today, you know, I have family and friends all over the world. Well, that's kind of something that's only in the past, you know.
Right.
What is that? Like 5% of human existence have we not been with our direct family all the time? So that's a new phenomenon for our species. And I think what these technologies are doing are catering to these fundamental needs for social connection, social acceptance. I mean, this is something that I think is very good. I would consider that a healthy habit.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it seems like, I wouldn't say many, but the idea of, you know, quote unquote habit forming, that model that we've been talking about that you're really an expert in, some called, I think, gamification, if they do elements of it, we're seeing a lot more of it. Do you think that we'll ever hit an addiction overload, like information overload, and start to reject it or tune it out? Or is it just a matter of refining how we do it?
Yeah, no, I think this is a fantastic question. And I'll let you in a little secret here for those who are still listening to this podcast. Yeah, the book is a bit of a Trojan horse. That I wrote the book for two main reasons. The number one reason for the book is because I want to give startup entrepreneurs who are struggling with trying to figure out how to create a product that people use, I want to help those people figure it out. I want to help them fail less by using some of these principles from consumer psychology to build healthy habits. Like I mentioned before, you know, I was in the gaming and advertising space. These techniques are nothing new, but they haven't been kind of let out into the greater community of product people and innovators and entrepreneurs. And I think that should change, that there's a lot of good that we can do by using these techniques to create healthy habits.
Well, and I look at it as, and I feel like I just pulled back the curtain on some of what we're doing at the Shook. So now I'm sure my community is like, I'm on to you, Tamara. I listened to the podcast. I know what you're doing to me. But I think in a healthy way to what you're saying, I look at it as we have this great platform and I want more people to have the opportunity to engage in it. So I'm going to use these.
Right. So, and I would think that as a healthy habit, right? If you can enhance people's lives, if you can create habits in their day-to-day lives that make them better off, that help them live happier, healthier, more connected lives, terrific. And that's what I want to help entrepreneurs do. So the reason you would buy the book is to think to yourself, hey, you know what? I want to create a great product that people love and people use. Now, the reason I call it a Trojan horse is that when you read the book, you will very soon realize that the products that you yourself are habituated to are not by accident. That these products are designed to be super engaging. It's not an accident. And I think that the world is becoming a potentially more addictive place.
Yeah.
And that the only way we can actually regain the focus and attention that we've lost at the hands of these devices is to realize what's going on.
Yeah.
Is to realize that these hooks exist in all sorts of products that we use every day, and that if we want to regain control and make sure that we that we control these products as opposed to these products controlling us, is to understand this deeper psychology so we can do something about it.
Well, I think it's a great opportunity for entrepreneurs to understand how to decrease the barriers and actually get a product into the hands of their customers in a way that's meaningful for them and will keep them coming back for more, which is important because that's the part I think entrepreneurs often and new products often miss. So I have two final questions for you.
Okay.
This is my Oprah Couch question. What's one thing people would be shocked to know about you?
One thing that people would be shocked to know
about. Yeah, like they'd
be
surprised. Like, I would never guess that about Nir.
Wow. I have to think about that one. I'm kind of a predictable guy. I don't know if there's a lot of there.
No, there's something in there.
Hobby. There's a lot of things that I do that's unconventional. You know, I took the words of Paul Graham. Paul Graham is the founder of Y Combinator, very famous Silicon Valley investor. Yeah. And he said something, I'm butchering this quote, but he said something to the effect, I'm paraphrasing here, of if you're not doing something different, then you're not normal.
Yeah.
Right? If you chew on that for a minute, right? That you have to be a little bit weird and a little bit different today, because just to be normal is actually kind of crazy. You know, you don't want to just be normal. So I try and test a lot of assumptions, right? Like one of the assumptions with this book that I test is that, oh, I use the things I use and I buy the things I buy just because I like them. And that's actually not the whole story. That many times we use these things because by design they are crafted to influence and persuade us. That we're not as in control of these purchasing decisions as we may always think. So there's a lot of ways that I challenge convention in many other aspects of my life in terms of what I eat and how I exercise and how we raise my kid. And so there's a few other ways.
So basically, you can't go to the grocery store without seriously analyzing everything.
I don't go to the grocery store. I order everything we buy in the house comes from either Google Shopping or from delivery service, from Safeway Delivery. And a big reason is I don't want that distraction. I don't want the noise. I want to go online and buy exactly what I need to buy from a
I
functional
love it.
standpoint. But maybe something that would be surprising to your listeners is that I struggle with these habit-forming technologies as much as anybody, that I realize how these things manipulate our behavior. And even I have had to institute breakers in my life to make sure that I don't go overboard. So I write just as much about how to break hooks in our life for these technologies that somehow persuade us to overuse them. I'm an advocate for breaking those hooks as much as I am an advocate for creating hooks around healthy habits.
You know, it's funny, the it's kind of a side note, but as you were talking, made me think about. So I've gotten really into CrossFit, and interestingly, as I was reading your book, I was thinking, wow, CrossFit as an activity very naturally has this model in place because of the way it's structured, and because you've got the board, the leaderboards, and you've got these variable workouts and time and how
The
much,
social rewards, sure.
social rewards, how much that applies to some of the physical things that we do as well.
I think that's a great example. That's a great example. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so last question is just one piece of advice for entrepreneurs out there. And you know, when I say entrepreneurs, it's kind of a wide spectrum, but when you're thinking about
Right.
someone who's,
Entrepreneurs, right.
yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there that encompasses a lot of people. So, you
Right,
know, people
right.
who've got a business out there, a product out there, who are now going to look at this hooked and think, I gotta think about this a little bit. What's one piece of
Right.
advice for them?
Well, I think it starts from, before you spend a lot of money on developing a product and building a product, I think taking a few minutes to understand what's your core hook, what's your trigger, action, reward, and investment. If you're building a habit-forming product, you need to be able to have those 4 steps nailed. Now, you still got to go out and build it. You still got to test it. You still got to learn from it. I'm taking a page here from The Lean Startup by Eric Ries and some of the work that Steve Blank has done. We still have to do that process of building, measuring, and learning. You still got to do that. But what I hope to do is to kind of save entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs the heartache of building the wrong thing by helping them have a framework that guides what they build sooner, so that you're using some kind of lattice on which you can build your product, that you're not just building it willy-nilly, you're using the deeper principles of consumer psychology to build your product.
You know, I'm glad you said entrepreneurs as well, because I think that that's as entrepreneurial, except maybe you're not, you know, the owner of the business. You are the director of innovation, or, you know, that person inside your company that pushes ideas forward. So I'm glad you said that. So, Nir, thank you so much. I'm going to put a link in the bottom on going to Amazon to buy Hooked. It was a tremendous, not just read, but kind of application manual. And I think that people out there, entrepreneur, will really appreciate that every chapter has those summaries and those action steps you talked about. And that this really isn't just an exercise in theory. You could actually go implement like I did on whether it's a small scale or a big scale, but it was fantastic, and I'm very appreciative that we got to spend this time digging into it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.